This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. This is episode 249 with Ruth Catlow. She is an artist and the co-director and founder of Further Field, which is kind of a gallery, kind of an institution, but is officially known as London's longest-running arts organization dedicated to decentralized network culture, which is to say, yes, there's a lot of digital, there's some blockchain. As we speak, or as you listen and I speak, Ruth is taking part in Art World DAW Think Tank in Berlin. You'll hear terms like DAWO at some point later in the conversation mentioned. That's an acronym for DAOWO, Decentralized Autonomous Organization with Others. It's part of the vocabulary around blockchain. And blockchain, just to give you a little context, is probably best known in the form of something called Bitcoin, which I imagine you are all, or almost all of you, are familiar with. It's sort of a digital currency, essentially, beyond the banks. So we don't talk all about blockchain. We do get into it in the latter part of the conversation. We actually kind of cover the arc of Ruth's life and career as an artist and programmer and curator and founding of Further Field. She started as a sculptor. So right around the time that during the time that the YBAs, the Young British Artists, were coming to the fore and to attention. So it's an interesting contrast, both with her work then and with her work now, in terms of it not being particularly mainstream. Although blockchain, of course, at the same time, is something that is garnering a lot more mainstream attention and activity. In so many words, we talk about that as well. The website for this here podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Ruth, of Further Field Gallery itself, which is located in a brick-and-mortar space in a park in North London, a few of her projects. Go check those out at the website. You can also support the show there. Check out our episode index of everything we've done before, including last episode where we did a blast from the past with Lisa Schiff. So good to be back with a regular episode, new episode, and hope you enjoyed that older one, though, because I'm sure a lot of you hadn't heard it. We will have some great old news / Weiss links on the back end again. And thank you for being here. Let's go ahead and jump to that conversation now. I will talk to you more on the back end. Stick around. I would love to hear you describe your background in art, which I think is an interesting backstory as related to, you know, this whole digital frontier.
Yes. Okay, so I started out as a sculptor. And then by the mid-90s, the young British art scene was well and truly underway in London. And I didn't like any of the options for where my sculptures might go. Like, if I was to make a living,
right?
I couldn't, selling the things that I was making to the people who were in my own circles, or in most of the circles that I would encounter in my daily life, wasn't going to be enough to earn me a living.
Let me jump in for a second, because I want to contextualize this and maybe get you to talk a little bit more about your perspective at that time. So first of all, just for people listening, the YBAs, as they have come to be known, the Young British Artists, who were very much associated with Charles Saatchi and, you know, the Sensation Show that was both there and I think in Brooklyn as well, if I remember right. So what was your relation, if any, to them? What did you think about their work? My sense from what you've said already is that you had some disdain for it.
Well, my kind of most immediate problem with it was what it did to what it did to communities of artists living in London. So around that time, I was part of a large number of people who were converting warehouses into studio spaces. And that started out as quite a kind of collective communal experience and a sense of shared mission. We were creating the spaces that we wanted to create work together and to have spaces where we could talk about things together. And the culture changed over a number of years, and I was just aware that artists were starting to lock themselves behind closed doors and squirrel gallerists away. And so there was this kind of, closing down and competitiveness. And at least my experience was a kind of less of a willingness to engage with kind of social or political questions.
Right. So it was both.
And of course, Saatchi was also behind, he was the PR company that got Margaret Thatcher into power. So I had particular feelings about that too.
Wow. Yeah. I think that's a really important detail that people probably, especially in the States, don't think of when they think of him. That's really interesting. So in other words, there was this professionalization going on with a number of these artists, and then there was this sort of capitalistic urge or impetus that was going on as well, which is like, you know, I'm going to take as much as I can get, you know, and I don't care about you kind of mentality.
Yeah. And also the kind of the conversion of art from many things into a marketing exercise that also involved a kind of collusion with the tabloids, which I think is a very particularly new kind of British thing as well. So that then it was like it was fermenting contempt for potential audiences as well. So it just kind of set up a kind of cartoonish relationship between artist as trickster and charlatan and audiences as Philistines, probably.
Right. Well said. Yeah. This was the beginning or the sort of the origin of your developing a rather democratic or socialist type perspective and interest in art making and an art community. Maybe that's not the best way to put it, but I'll let you alter
I think that's the way I would describe it now, but it might be post-rationalization. So I had these gut feelings that were kind of that were acting on me. And then at the same time, in the mid 90s, I went and hosted at one of London's first cyber cafes that was kind of dedicated to creative exploration called Backspace. And and just kind of encountered people who were experimenting with the early days of the web as a kind of artistic space, set of tools and context. And of course that then meant that anything you made could automatically be shared with a bunch of other people around the world who were taking the same, who were kind of on the same path. So that was really exciting. I've always made work at the same time as creating platforms and curating and organizing and writing.
So what is your work been like? How would you describe it?
So in the early days, it was really easy to make works that played with the same materials that the platforms were made with. So because the tech was less complex, it was easy for me as an artist just to teach myself enough to make like interactive GIFs or non-linear kind of GIF films that would play differently depending on how you clicked through it. I spent quite a lot of time doing things where I would make things like sculptures and then, I'm air quoting, gift them to public space and invite people then to respond, and then documenting responses online. So kind of creating physical to digital bridges. And then I think the the first piece of work that I made where I felt like I'd really done something that was kind of idiomatic as a network piece was a piece called Rethinking War Games, which was a game. It was a art, it was a kind of game artwork, which was three player chess.
Mm-hmm.
The third player played the pawns together. And it kind of sprang from an image that I've put out. So all the kind of chess bulletin boards with the pawns aligned on one side and the higher pieces on the other, with the question, under what conditions could the pawns in this game win? And it was at the time when the Allies were starting aggression in Iraq, and I'd been to a lot of demonstrations. And so it was kind of really trying to crowdsource some responses to how we might organise differently, for it not always to be about a war of the rich against the poor, but framed as a tribal thing.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm seeing early on, or what I'm hearing early on for you, is not only an activist, you know, angle or element involved, but also, as you alluded to earlier or described earlier, the social element of the making, and that there was the opportunity for virtually an instant feedback scenario, as opposed to the, you know, the object world where, you know, depending on where you are and how much attention you have, your work, your sculpture in your case, might be seen by your friends over the course of a month, you know, here and there, whereas, you know, these digital projects could be seen by multiple people and not only seen, but also added to, you know, responded to and so on, you know, the same day that you put it out and so on.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't really thought of that before, but that's very true.
Yeah, I mean, it's
like this kind of, the early days of the web were really exciting because the materials that you were working with was a kind of creating frames for different kinds of ensemble work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So finding, like, putting the doors at different levels in a piece to work out where it was going to be changed or what access people would have or which bits people would be able to shape and which bits you were framing and keeping kind of rigid. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, when you said, what I'm interested about what you said is the word ensemble, because I'm imagining that like 90%+ of these ensembles or these shared or collaborative works are virtual in connection. Correct me if I'm wrong. And to what extent was that there a learning curve or a, you know, a social satisfaction curve, you know, as far as getting as much out of a collaborative process that is all virtual versus in the flesh?
Yeah, I guess what was interesting about like the early days of the web is that there was a lot less noise and there was a lot less kind of the consumer culture hadn't really manifested itself and hadn't taken over as it has now.
Mm.
And so the people we were connecting with were, you could make a much more, the connection that you made was often more potent because you were connecting with people who you had a much more pre-identified shared interest with. The people we met online at that time,
mm-hmm,
were people who were exploring in the same way that we were.
Yeah.
So you could go quite deep, quite fast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like everyone wasn't already preconditioned to behave in certain ways by the platforms they were already using.
Right. Right.
So that was really satisfying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So well, it kind of replaced the tactility of sculptural materials, maybe.
Yeah, sure. I think this will be a never-ending question for me as far as, I mean, because it's certainly something that has been coming up in with a lot of force lately, which is to say our connection to our devices. So I gather, I do understand how the early days of the web, as you put it, you know, were nothing like what we're dealing with in the last, you know, 10, 15, whatever years, that, you know, it was much more intimate. There wasn't the noise that we have now and so on. But still, you know, when you're in a chat room, or whether it's a chat room or collaborating on a piece, you know, like you're like, as you said, you're working on kind of the same type of project or the same project specifically, the feedback you're getting is all words on a screen. You know what I mean? There's something very different about that than having somebody at your studio talking to you about your work, for example.
So people who are in their 20s and 30s in the late 80s and 90s, who did an awful lot of their socializing and romantic and love life and sex life online, and things just had a kind of, it had a different kind of frisson, actually. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the effort that one made to tell jokes, because you just didn't have the richness or the bandwidth with which to communicate with people. And I think you get a flavor of that in kind of what meme culture has turned into. This is why meme culture is so successful, is because people find they take great pleasure in expressing their sense of belonging in a very, along a very narrow bandwidth.
Mm.
Because they have a kind of close shared sense of cultural humor.
Mm-hmm. Is there a healthy side to the meme culture? Because if there is, I'm under aware of it.
Oh, I don't know. There are some memes that can make me laugh in a way that no other kind of format can.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Dogecoin meme era was unalloyed joy for me. I'm not... Yeah, it sounds like I'm evangelizing. Mm-hmm. I'm not proud of it, but it hits certain kind of triggers, I suppose.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I gotcha. I should get a list of you of memes that I should check out.
Because yes,
I'm only being exposed to the really sophomoric and lame and violent meme type culture,
yeah,
these days.
Which is, things have gone really bad,
yeah,
in the last few years, let's face it.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, to go back to that word nostalgic, I mean, I think it's, we don't have to point the finger at you for being nostalgic when, in fact, it's very easy to imagine a more intimate, workable, livable web community, you know, back in the 90s than what we've had, you know, with all the platforms over the last decade or whatever it is, you know.
Well, I guess the other thing that was important was that we were always pushing towards working with free and open source software.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of problems now looking back on kind of the ethos and the cultures that we were working within, because they actually just essentially weren't sustainable. And they left a lot of things open for exploitation, and there are lots of problems. But nevertheless, the kind of ethos of making things open, accessible, that people can take and reuse for their own purposes, there was a kind of communality to it that when kind of like from the mid-noughties, and you have the big five come up, and these are all platforms that then look free, but they're harvesting data for really quite sinister purposes. Mm-hmm. And essentially commercializing our social relations.
Right.
And without doing it for a really long time with people really thinking through what this is doing, because it's a kind of global cybernetic system. And if you have commerce at the heart of that unquestioned, then basically you're pouring paraffin on a system that is just going to grow and grow and grow. And then here we are.
Mm. Just as an aside before we continue, I do want to point out, because you had written this in your the intro to this blockchain book that you and your colleagues put out, where you use the term noughties to refer to, I guess, the aughts or the 2000s. Is that an English thing?
I think it might be.
Yeah.
I have been edited out of using noughties before, but I don't know. Maybe I made it up. I don't think I did.
It's pretty funny. yeah, it's and I almost, the way it was contextualized, it felt very serious. So it was like, no, this is just the way we refer to that period.
I think that is just the way we refer to that period.
Oh, okay. That's fascinating. Why don't we segue into, since we haven't brought this up yet, into further field, how you would describe it as a gallery, and because it is actually a brick and mortar space, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is really pretty surprising. But maybe talk about how long it's been around, what the genesis for it was, and what kind of programming it does.
Yeah, okay. So further field as a, I guess, as a community, we built our own platform back in 1996, then spent until 2004 making different kinds of platform for collaboration, where we were making things together with people in different parts of the world.
Let me interrupt you for just a second. When you talk about making things, can you try to plan a visual image in people's head as to maybe the typical kind of thing you guys were making?
Yes. So we made a platform working with an artist and developer called Neil Jenkins, and the platform was called Visitors Studio. Mm. This was essentially a browser space that you could upload images, small sound loops, or small video loops, like really small. I can't remember how much they were, like 150 kilobytes or something. Mm. And then you could add them to a layered space. So you could, the browser could hold 8 different layers at any one time, and you could change their size and transparency and volume, or you could flip them. But what was exciting was that you could do that. Other people would be in that same browser space at the same time as you. You could see their cursor with their name under the cursor, mm-hmm. And you could chat with them at the same time. Mm. So you were kind of, it was like an always on collage filmic space. Mm-hmm. And we ran a whole series of events in these spaces. So we ran one called the Dissension Convention, which coincided with the second Bush's second convention before he got reelected in the States. Mm-hmm. And we held it in solidarity with all the suffering American artist friends that we had. Mm-hmm. And this was broadcast into cafes and galleries, and it was as a kind of creative space. It was a space that you could just about make the thing hold together with about 3 or 4 people making things at any one time, but you could have 30 people in the space also with their cursors bobbing around heckling all at the same time. so you'd have argued, like the conversation would be happening in the same space where the work was being made. So that's one example.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And before you continue with further field, I just want to say real quick that your description of the, you know, solidarity with people in the States when Bush got reelected, the meme, going back to memes, the meme that I remember from that time is the Sorry Everybody website. Does that ring a bell?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Continue.
It's a shame in a way that kind of it's a kind of sense of heartfelt at the same time as tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
It's very hard to achieve that on a mass scale anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were those were the kind of spaces that we were creating, and we were living in a warehouse space in North London.
Is this you and your partner you're talking about when you say we?
My partner. So this is Mark Garrett and I. So right. Mark had a much longer history in network communication, kind of DIY culture than I did. So he'd come up through bulletin boards and pirate radio and all this kind of like build your own platform, make your own noise. This is our culture. If we say it's art, then it's art kind of situation.
Right.
And So yeah, so this was us, but we had a warehouse space that was large enough that we could have people come to stay. So we had informal residencies and people would just come and hang out and work together.
Mm-hmm.
And we opened our first show in 2004 with an exhibition by a Finnish artist called Erkki Kurniemi. And he was the this is like such a brilliant tech history story, tech history culture. He was the inventor of DIMI, of MIDI, but he called it DIMI, and MIDI was the one that stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd never made the huge wealth that he should have done, because the person who invented MIDI was the one that made the money.
Wow.
But his show was called The Future Isn't What It Used to Be. And I think he was my first encounter with someone who was attempting to outlive their body. So it was the first kind of transhumanist project. So he was trying to record every memory, every ticket, every physical encounter that he had, so that his consciousness could be uploaded into the computer once the singularity came.
Hmm.
And then from then on, we basically hosted between 3 and 5 exhibitions of art that could only exist after the networked age, or in an age that you might call the networked age. I know we're London's kind of longest running arts organization dedicated to decentralized network culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we've commissioned work, we've exhibited things, we've toured things, we work with artists really from right across the spectrum. We do have a kind of preference, I think, for work that is reflexive in terms of the way it uses and thinks about technology. So we're not really that interested in faster, brighter, slicker, you know, that isn't really our interest.
You know what I think of when you just make that term that you just did, what? By contrast? I thought of Pace Gallery and their Bay Area Gallery. I don't know if it's up yet, but it's those kinds of projects that I think you're referring to in contrast, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. We've never been, I don't think we've ever been referred to as entertaining.
And to go back, just a moment, just for listeners and to some extent myself, to clarify decentralized network projects, how would you make that a little bit more clear, you know, in a vernacular sense?
Okay, so after the web, people were in touch with people who were very different to themselves from all over the world in all new kinds of ways. It's like a new kind of sociality. So let me give you some examples. So here in my studio at the moment, I have 2 posters on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
One is by an artist called Kate Rich, who has run a project, I think, since 2004, but it might be older than that, called Feral Trade. So it's a play on fair trade.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of artist-crafted database of goods, so drinks and edibles, that are carried in the spare space in people's baggage as they travel the art world. And she trades coffee from across the Central and Southern Americas, different kinds of alcohol, salt, herbs, and these are all tracked with their stories attached to them about how these things are passed from hand to hand. So it's this kind of weird alternative economy of food that basically shows up the networks of artists traveling. So it's a kind of weird parasitical piece of work that sits on top of the art world.
Mm-hmm.
And gives us a way to think about how we could do things less efficiently, but paying more attention to the stories and the flavors and the kind of relationships between people. And so we ran the first Feral Trade Cafe at our gallery. And then if you ordered a meal, the meal would be served to you from the Feral Trade kind of menu, and you would your menu, your placemat would have on it details of all the journeys and all the hands that the ingredients had passed through, and various accounts and stories and difficulties that she calls them mules, so that the people who carried the stuff have encountered on the way. So you're getting this kind of very rich picture of what this kind of food network looks like.
Right.
So that's one example. And then another example would be like Heath Bunting's status project, which, so Heath, we have in the past bought a passport off Heath as an artwork for £500 that he has created, starting by creating a false identity, starting with acquiring Sainsbury's loyalty card, for instance, and then gradually built up an identity for a person that doesn't exist, to the point, like through library cards and then setting up. So he's kind of built this map of the social and political databases that allow you to understand what it is to become a legal human being and then acquire a passport.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, so these kind of analyses of digital culture that post network.
Yeah, but I think it's noteworthy that they both have a very tangible element to them as well, which is not necessarily something I would have expected from all your projects.
It's always been it's always been really important to me that the thing that people encounter is something that is not holding back, you know, that people have a rich experience in front of a piece of artwork.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the networked artworks that we make are screen based. One of my favorite networked artists is a performance artist called Annie Abrahams, and she creates these, I guess they're like instructional pieces. So they're ensemble instructional pieces where people appear in a browser that she has constructed in a particular way. She invites them to behave in a certain way, and she records their behavior. They can hear and see each other. So they're kind of co-creating a screen-based work between them, but it's live and improvised. So, and they're improvising to an instruction. So one was called Angry Women, and the instruction was express your anger until you have no anger left. But you're doing it in a grid of 12 women. So it's really performing the cybernetic process, the kind of feedback systems of doing things together, making collective works.
Mm-hmm. I want to point out, because you did mention a little while ago, the art world, which you also make mention of in your introduction to the blockchain book. And it's interesting thinking about the type of digital / conceptual or contemporary conceptual work that, you know, you're showing, and it being very fringe of, you know, to a certain extent compared with, you know, the quote unquote art world. But I do want to, before you maybe address that, I do want to point out that that you've had a partnership with a guy named Ben Vickers of Unmonastery, which does sound like very much along the lines of what Furtherfield is, but also with Serpentine Galleries, which is much more of a mainstream art world institution, correct? So I guess I just wonder, among other questions, is Serpentine a model that you're much happier to associate with than something like what I described with Pace Bay Area, you know, being this much more flashy, slick type situation?
Well, first I should say, because I can't remember if I've told you, that Furtherfield is now based in a park. So Furtherfield Gallery, and we have a space called the Furtherfield Commons, which is a community lab space. We're now based in a park in North London. And when we opened, the first news item about the opening of our gallery was the People's Serpentine of North London.
Mm-hmm.
How they described us.
What did you think of that description?
I loved it.
Oh, good. Uh-huh.
I loved it because it's kind of, well, for a start, it is kind of saying the Serpentine's gallery is not the people's gallery.
Right.
And also, when we moved to the middle of this park in Haringey, which is a North London borough, very diverse North London borough, 180 different languages spoken in this park, that one of our strongest kind of enthusiasms about this space was that it was going to help us to become more disciplined about presenting work that would otherwise possibly have been quite abstract and maybe a little obtuse,
mm-hmm.
but it would help us to get better at making the work, presenting the work in a way that was more communicable and like spoke directly to people's life and experience. That was always really important with our move to the park. So there's that. And then Serpentine, so I personally have a long-running collaboration with Ben Vickers, especially around the blockchain stuff. But there has been a recent disaster at the Serpentine.
Right, PR disaster.
Yeah, well, their CEO, Jan Appel.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah. So it was discovered that she was a majority shareholder in Pegasus, which is a cybersecurity firm with a very bad record of dobbing in dissidents to violent governments.
Yeah.
And so that and the Serpentine's 3-year slogan, safe space for dangerous ideas, just becomes really difficult and really chilling, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So this is creating it. I found it was pretty hard to take, actually, on a personal level, just because I have people who I care for who have put really a lot of good, like decent, like proper work into trying to do something authentic in that space. And it just rips the heart out of it, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm aware that that it comes across as incredibly naive, possibly, to think that it would ever be otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I do long for a little more, meshing between the cultures that underpin, that run, that empower these organizations, and the content and the messages that they are platforming. It just feels like very undermining otherwise. Yeah. And I know that this is kind of part of a process that's really going on in the States at the moment as well. I saw Gregory Shalette talking about exactly this in the States with the kind of decolonization protests. And I know Lisa from Wage as well, and I've been following that campaign. So these are this kind of a drive to bring ethics to the art world is on the one hand, the art world can view it as PR, but I think it's a really deep, it's a deep wound, actually.
Yeah.
For all artists, and we're all kind of carrying it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it actually makes me think about, to go back kind of to the beginning of our conversation, the split that you went into by getting out of the material art world and into the digital, eventually the digital one.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the YBAs and so on. I mean, and Saatchi, you know, those are that's exemplary of the baggage that goes along with the high art world. And,
yeah.
And maybe they're, you know, through sheer momentum or a combination of multiple events, maybe things are changing in that regard. But it's always going to be a moving target, isn't it, in some ways?
Yeah,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no purity.
Right,
and
right.
Yeah, I mean...
What about in your world? Is there purity in your world?
No, of course not.
Uh-huh. Well, talk about that. I mean, without too much of a tangent, I mean, to what extent... Do you find, I mean, without, we can get into maybe in a moment, you know, the the dark side of blockchain, which I'm sure is pretty easy for you to do. But what about just in the DAO, you know, community, if you will?
So the question of whether it's pure, I'm not sure I know what I can say about that. I mean, it's not, it doesn't suffer from the things that the kind of mainstream or established art world suffers from, because certainly the DAO community, which is pretty small, mm-hmm. is pretty niche and pretty small. There is not a lot of money flowing there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is, it's still very, it's still fermenting, you know, so that isn't yet a problem for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think really the, like, so in London at the moment, to be an artist who is making any kind of living, it's really hard for artists to make any kind of living these days, I think. And so there's this sense that, like, the pyramidic art world where yeah. all money and power is flowing to the top, mm-hmm. it's going to run out of steam soon, because there aren't things flowing up.
Mm-hmm.
That it's pretty much kind of scorched earth. Like, we're losing a lot of the kind of middle ranking galleries in London.
Sure.
Anyway.
Yep. That's been going on here too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and since austerity policies have hit in London, it just means that those people that dare take on the debt to go to art school are leaving and having not a lot of work and not really able to maintain a life where they can still make work. And also Furtherfield's very rare small organization that still has a space for kind of emerging artists. The ecology for emerging artists is really, like, it's sipping up the last few bits of air as well.
Mm-hmm.
So sorry to be so apocalyptic, but it is true.
No, I think we need to honor reality to whatever extent it comes into the conversation. And speaking of which, I was going to ask this maybe a lot later, but you did mention, you know, people going to art school and the pyramidal structure and so on. What's the monetization situation with Furtherfield and its, you know, I think I partially maybe mentioned on Monastery and Serpentine galleries, and, you know, there are others obviously, but you know where are the sources of income for you in Furtherfield and or other projects?
Okay, so for us, we receive a small amount of regular funding, hallelujah, from the Arts Council, which mm-hmm. is government public funding.
Mm-hmm.
We're required to at least double that to honor the contract, which we do through a scrabble for commissions, mainly through commissions and other grant funding, or through delivering touring programs or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's kind of, yeah, it's a patchwork.
Yeah. Is it precarious at times?
Yes. Uh-huh. Always. Always totally precarious.
Right. And you mentioned when we spoke last time that you're north of the city where you live, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it similarly costly up there, or?
Yes. There's mm-hmm. we don't live in London anymore. We can't afford to live there. So we live 40 miles east on the north of the Thames Estuary in a place called Southend, which is very nice.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of people can't afford to live in London anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, but what I was asking is, so in Southend where you live, yeah. is the distance enough so that your cost of living is rather manageable?
Yes.
Yeah. Got
yeah.
it. Yeah. Right. Right.
I mean, yeah, I consider myself, like, at the fortunate end of mm-hmm. people working in the arts in London.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a mixture of things. It's also, like, in terms of the struggle to kind of keep the you know, the kind of structural integrity of a running organization that is trying also to not rip everyone we work with off.
Yeah.
So there's that on the one hand, which is, you know, like, so that's a job. But the thing that really makes it worthwhile, and I think, like, maybe this is the flip side of the question about whether it's corrupt, mm-hmm. is the thing that makes it all worthwhile is that we're kind of building a network of radical friendship. That feels like the thing worth doing.
Right.
So this is building rich networks of people who support each other in a number of ways that are both cultural and material and social and all of those kinds of things.
Right. And is your community all over the world then?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No particular concentration in any particular parts?
Probably more Europe and North America.
Okay.
But we have people who we collaborate with probably on every continent, maybe not the Arctic continents.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking that, you know, you would probably be a little bit disappointed if we ran out of time and barely got to blockchain at all. And certainly keep in mind the listenership, you know, not being like me particularly well versed. I think it is safe to say that Bitcoin is the most well known example of a type of blockchain. But why don't you? I don't want you to necessarily launch into a whole lecture of blockchain 101, but maybe to sort of build on what you were saying quite a bit earlier. You know, that you, Rob Myers, this great friend of yours and thinker, introduce you to it. You gravitated towards it. You did a little Bitcoin mining. Should we fast forward to your more recent work with it, perhaps?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Where shall I land?
Right.
It's a tricky one. We've done, if we go back to the moment where we put out a call where we said, come and work with us to build a commons for the art of the networked age and help us think through blockchain and what's going on with data.
Mm.
That was in 2015, I think. And so since then, we've curated and toured a number of exhibitions. And the first one was called The Human Face of Crypto Economies. And that had in it a very early blockchain artwork by Rob Myers called Facecoin.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what that was doing was that it was taking a grayscale pixel map of kind of blockchain hashes. So these are the kind of very long numbers, putting them into grids of kind of grayscale pixels, and then running them through a facial recognition software. And saying that if blockchain is proof of work, then art is proof of aesthetic work. So it was doing the kind of the machine finds a face in this grid.
Mm.
And what artists do is make portraits. So this is a kind of early playing with the materials of blockchain that looks great. You're looking for faces in these grids. And then you're realizing that it's a machine kind of trying to pretend to be an artist or being an artist or being called an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And then it produces the faces that it produces. It says is coins. And that shouldn't be the example that you give.
Okay.
Let me skip to. So the second exhibition we did was called New World Order. And it was really looking at how there were a number of artists working with blockchains to show how embedded in it were these kind of options for rethinking both natural and social systems. And there's two really good example pieces in this that are kind of quite didactic, and therefore I like them because it makes it easy to talk about why blockchain is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So one's called Plantoid, which is a robotic... It's an Android plant that dances and glows when you feed it Bitcoin.
Mm.
And when it's accrued enough money, it then commissions an artist to make its babies. And those that have tipped it with Bitcoin get to have a say in what its baby's makeup will be. And it isn't just what it looks like, but it's what its financial contract will be. Mm-hmm. So you get to say whether it will be a charitable plantoid. So there's plantoids out there that are gifting 50% of their tips to a charity. Don't ask me which charity, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, it's all, what I like about this is it's also somewhat like a pyramid scheme, i.e. somewhat like some blockchains. And at the same time, it's the Primavera de Filippi, who's one of the artists of Okeos who made this, talks about it as a kind of evolutionary art form on the blockchain, because each time you make a new plantoid, it's always feeding Bitcoin up to the mother plant. So it's like this kind of community of plants that are growing and changing, and there's ever more of them, and they're made in some kind of community with the people who fund it. This is a very blockchain-y project because it's got kind of crowdfunding in it. It's got governance in it. It's combining governance and aesthetics in quite an interesting way. I think it's a very strong project.
So these plantoids are pleasant to take in on your computer screen?
They are big, physical, like cyberpunk, metal sculptures.
I
will send you pictures.
That will include those with the episode page. Yes. That sounds great. Okay.
Then the other one is Terra Zero, which these are both projects that people should look up because they're still, although these came out in 2017, I think, mm-hmm. they've still got kind of quite strong vibrations, I think.
Yeah.
And Terra Zero was, it basically was a forest that comes to own itself. So it becomes a legal entity in order to manage the capital that it produces. And I think one of the things that I find quite fascinating about these works is that they're kind of pointing at what quite a lot of interesting artworks that work with technology do, which is pointing at a reversal to the kind of master-slave relationship between humans and computers. Mm-hmm. And you suddenly get this image actually of these kind of computer systems which are which human beings serve to maintain. So we are now organized, we're being organized to maintain these computer systems. This is really becomes creepy and weird.
And that's a great segue to sort of what one of my takeaways from your introduction in the blockchain book, as far as the art blockchain projects and the general mindset, is that the objective is to have the power decentralized, ironically or counterintuitively, into the computer system, and that it's a benign, non-caring version of that, which runs in contrast to, you know, what I think a lot of people associate with, you know, the various blockchain movements, which are running, you know, Bitcoin and so on, which are running too far into speculation and investors and so on.
Yeah, I mean, that is the blockchain, the blockchain, let's call it blockchain snake oil tonight.
Yeah.
Is that we can avoid politics by going to pure computer systems. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that because they are consensus driven, then they are fair. Mm-hmm. And because the computer is decentralized, then power must be decentralized. None of these things are true. So I'm quite driven to be in this space, A, because I'm fascinated by it. Mm-hmm. I think there is an argument to be made for people to bring a kind of critical analysis and critical artistic sensibility to blockchain, both as a medium and as a culture, because if we abandon this space, it just becomes overtaken by this technology has quite a lot of power to mm-hmm. mobilize things, and we need to diversify the people who are working with it and thinking about it.
Mm. And is that one of the is that one of the
this
projects
is a strong motivation.
Sorry?
This is a strong motivation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
We're trying to diversify the people who are in this space mm-hmm. and who have access, who can think it through. Because it's like people do say to me straight-facedly, people who are developed blockchain or kind of crypto developers, the kind of model of blockchain is that people need to be incentivized, need to be financially incentivized to do things. And this is a good thing. It's the only reliable model. People do think people only do the right thing when you incentivize them with money.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard some really smart, intelligent people say that. And when I say, yeah, but that isn't true, is it? Yeah. People aren't only incentivized to do things with money. That it's, I might be the first person that said that to them.
Mm.
And that it just feels important that there are lots of, I'm sounding very pompous, but it does feel important to me that there are people who are kind of not allowing that just to go unchecked
mm-hmm.
on one hand. And then also there's actual work going on, developmental work going on in our networks to building cooperative infrastructures. I'm currently working on the Disco infrastructure project with the guys from Commons Transition and Guerrilla Media, and we're looking at how we might build cooperatives with the feminist economics at the heart of them. So there is this kind of like, yeah, we can build stuff
mm-hmm.
and the tech is just getting to a point where we might be able to do this kind of stuff.
Right. And what is your response to just the general question as far as if you're taking the, you know, this is a this decentralization and giving the power to the unthinking or the unbiased, you know, computer core, if you will, is prone to manipulation or corruption or, you know, hacking.
If the question is, why are we giving our energy to this thing? Is that the question?
No, no. I'm sorry. I didn't articulate that very well. So if we take as our premise, I should say, if we take as one of our premises around the blockchain, type of blockchain work that you're interested in, one of the benefits of it is that there's no particular motivation. There's no investment on the part of the computer, of the system, you know. Therefore, we can allow democratic distribution or application of various things to it, to this entity. Does that make sense? I'm not articulating it very well, but do you get the gist of what I'm getting
yes.
at? Yeah. So you can probably re-articulate that for me. But so if that is our premise, then what about the question of, well, what about hacking to that, you know, otherwise neutral system?
Okay. So I don't think the systems are never neutral. They are always built by a group of people for a certain purpose.
Yeah.
With open source blockchains, you can kind of interrogate that a bit. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see what kinds of things they're being set up to do.
Right.
Some of the blockchain projects have been very famously hacked
mm-hmm.
and that's been fascinating because there's part of the kind of blockchain theology is that it's immutable and therefore if something happens, a hack is as much the truth as somebody's intentional build. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? And so in the Ethereum blockchain we saw $5 million drained out of a crowdfund and then them roll back the blockchain to fix the hole that allowed them to hack it.
Mm-hmm.
And that created all kinds of convulsions basically in the blockchain culture.
Right.
But so there's those kinds of hacks. But the way, I mean, at the moment I think global democracy is being hacked on such a massive level from mm-hmm. all these different angles that in a way technical hacking is the least of our problems.
Mm.
And I think actually one of the things that attracted me to blockchain after the web was that it has, it's quite hard to explain this without sounding mad, but the fact that it has money baked in means that it means that if we build infrastructure on it, we have to account for everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's an accounting system built into this. So we can't imagine that everything is free and abundant and will never have to be paid for.
Right. That doesn't sound mad at all.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find that kind of like in the current ecological system, and I find that a kind of useful thing.
Is an open source blockchain, maybe based on what I was trying to get at earlier around a level playing field, one of the best candidates for a fair and equally distributed system?
Lots of people might say yes, I wouldn't be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because you'll never have one blockchain. So people can always skirt around the system and use a different one that they've built themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The only way, the best way is the best way that it's always been, is for humans to dig inside themselves and find the best of themselves and find other people and coordinate and resist and aim for the best society that they can imagine using right. all the tools and everything.
Yeah.
You know, one technology is not going to solve this. Blockchain is interesting because it helps us to think about the relationship between money and governance. And to come back to my point about democracy, the fact that we don't have money, we don't see money and governance together, we don't talk about how these things relate to each other or are impinging on each other, is why we're in the state we're in at the moment, I think.
Mm-hmm. And before we run out of time, let's see if we can reconcile blockchain as a technology, you know, generally, with blockchain as an art form, particularly in this context of this show. To some extent, a lot of this is technology and technological innovation, right? So would one of your premises be that the artist's take on the blockchain is really invaluable in the conversation, and that's the angle, that's the community that you're involved in?
So at this stage, there isn't one community. There's quite a lot of different communities, all coming at it from different angles.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my take on it is that artists are really interesting when they approach new technologies, because they sense how these technologies are going to move in the world, what their potential is, what changes they might make,
mm-hmm.
and they put a image on it, or they put an interaction on it, or they create an environment that helps people to apprehend those things.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of like early movers into the space, and they help people to get a sense of what's coming.
Right. Is there anything you feel we would be remiss if I didn't ask you or you didn't mention?
I think maybe one thing that I haven't talked about that is the most fun, which is how we've been working with live action role play in this space. So we've been using live action role play because one of the things that this is, so that when I say we, this is me and Ben Vickers, and then more recently so I produced a LARP with Ben Vickers, and then we both worked with Ed Fornielis, and then I've been working more recently with Penny Rafferty, and these are on LARP based projects. And what's so brilliant about the live action role play thing is that you can bring people with from zero to all the knowledge about the tech and the culture into one space and create a fiction where you live in a world that is created communally in order to explore what effects these things might have. So that's very abstract. The one I created with Ben was basically a 2-day hackathon. The scenario was Cattersey Cats Home is running out of money, while cats online are as popular as ever. In real life, no one cares about cats anymore. And the chair of the board of Cattersey Cats Home has a friend who's told them that blockchain is the answer to everything. So they run a two-day hackathon to find out what they could do that might save them from bankruptcy. So that's the scenario. And then we ran a two-hour workshop because we were running our two-day hackathon in cat time. So everything was speeded up six times. Mm. And basically we ran an event in which people were assigned as developers, marketeers, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and they made pitches for projects that we had written, and then they had to work out what those projects were and then sell them back to us. So it's like this kind of very intense speed process where people then have to invent something very quickly that is a bit blockchainy and work out how the money's going to be split whilst pretending to be someone else. And they're given license to behave really pretty much however they like because it might have been written into their character. So it's all this kind of make-believe. It gives people a way to relax into learning something new and a bit threatening very fast. Mm-hmm. And none of the things that we've done in LARPs have been anywhere near as strange as what actually goes on in the real cryptocurrency world, as far as I can tell.
What do you mean? Can you expand on that a little bit?
I've been to a number of conferences, mm-hmm, where you just see the most bizarre behavior from the leaders, and it's because I'm going to become a pseudo-psychologist here, mm-hmm, but I think it's because they've made such insane amounts of money, mm, that they believe that they are superhuman.
Right.
And they say all kinds of crazy rubbish, mm-hmm, and no one counters them. So they go on, they just think everything they say must be amazing.
Wow. And there's nobody there to shoot them down?
No.
Wow. That's gotta discourage you from going to these conferences.
Well, except that it just becomes a bit of a, it's fascinating. Hmm. It's fascinating to, I mean, I'm imagining it's probably a little bit like early days web, probably when the dot-com boom was going.
Right.
I think it's probably quite similar to that.
When you say that these guys are just so, you know, they're so wealthy, they think they're superhuman, are they wealthy in the symbolic sense, or have they cashed out to some extent?
Probably a mix.
Yeah.
I don't. Yeah.
Right. So one, yeah. I mean, in theory, one of those people could go bust at any given point, right?
Well, I mean, the last, about, when was it? Where are we now? Yeah. So about 18 months ago, maybe not quite that long ago, people made huge amounts of money, and then some people really lost a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. At the time when there was a lot of the initial coin offering, so people were investing hand over fist in blockchain projects,
yeah,
and then there was a huge price drop,
right?
And you saw businesses that had basically, they'd been planning for 10-year liquidity to roll out their new technologies, suddenly everyone was talking about shortening runways. So now they were going to have to deliver something in 3 years, and they were cutting staff and all this kind of stuff. So very kind of volatile kind of development space.
Yeah.
But to me, that's really fascinating, because what it's doing is that it's putting actually the basis of an awful lot of global kind of financial markets and the financial business. It's basically just doing that, but doing it with tech. So it just gave me a real insight into just this kind of boom and bust the speculative psychology. It's really stressful for, yeah, a lot of people. Yeah.
And speaking of stressful, I was kind of, as you were saying that, I was kind of imagining that the world you inhabit is sort of cramped into the middle between the tech world, as you sort of just described it, on one side, and the art world on the other. That's got to be a weird place to be in, huh? Or do it's you not very... think of it like that?
Oh, God, it's really odd.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very, very odd. I don't know what I'm doing here.
could not be a more perfect place to end this conversation. Ruth, it's been so fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And we're out.
Thank you very much again to Ruth for talking to me. I hope you guys got a lot out of that, found it intriguing. Maybe it will make you want to explore further field and blockchain perhaps in general, or some aspects of it in particular. Maybe you want to check out Terra Zero for starters. Before we move on to the old news, and there are some good ones coming up, including one related to what we talked about, I want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. Your support really does help this show keep going, particularly your financial support. If you could make a donation today, that would be fantastic. If you make a donation of $35 or more, you will get all 10 of the bonus episodes. If you give a donation of 25 or more, I'll give you the most recent couple and put you on the mailing list, but might as well go for the whole bonanza. You can also support the show by leaving a great review on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever platform you listen on, following us at Artist Podcast on social media, and perhaps also equally important, spreading the word about the show so that more people listen. Big thanks, as always, to the ongoing, especially the yearly, but also the monthly, and every once in a while, contributors to the show. And if you want to be on that list, if you donate a certain amount, there's a list of patrons of the conversation with links to their sites on the support page, conversationpod.com/support. So check that out. Consider becoming a supporter yourself. I want to thank Andy Davis, as always, for pointing me in the right direction with the best footage for this episode. Thanks so much, Andy. And now, with all that said, let's get to the old news, aka Weislinks, courtesy of producer Megan Bickle. Here's the one that I thought would be a nice contrast, and it comes courtesy of past guest Tim Schneider from ArtNet. It's called Common Denominator, and it goes, "To be clear, I'm not necessarily saying that Team Lab is the Big Bang Theory of time-based media, or that Pace," yes, the gallery we talked about in our conversation, "is the Disney of contemporary galleries. And even the harshest critic would be hard-pressed to conflate Pace X with the Museum of Ice Cream. However, I do think it's noteworthy that most, if not all, of the Pace artists who look primed for Pace X projects have a tendency to go big and spectacular with their work. Aside from Team Lab and Random International, Leo Villarreal is out here lighting up bridges, Studio Drift is levitating cement monoliths, and Mikhail Rovner is no stranger to dominating a gallery with a monumental graphic video installation. Even the gallery's godfathers of phenomenological art thrive on monumentality. Robert Irwin, a few weeks away from turning 91, has been warping our perceptions of entire spaces for decades, while James Turrell has spent more than 30 years transforming Roden Crater into a, quote, naked eye observatory, unquote, partly through commissions for sky spaces and room-commanding light installations. Although I'd personally argue that stark differences separate Irwin and Turrell, two of my all-time favorites, from Team Lab and Random International, Glimcher," that's Arnold Glimcher of Pace, by the way, "placed all four in the same lineage during his interview with Goldstein. From a superficial standpoint, I know what he's saying, which is exactly my point. The types of technologically or experientially inclined artists who will benefit from ticket sales are the ones whose works can, and often already do, consistently draw crowds with awe-inducing, Instagram-ready visuals, whether they communicate something more revelatory or not. In my experience, many, if not most, young artists working with technology and time-based media embrace those tools because they either wanted to do so or felt they were only capable of doing something quieter, weirder, and or more revolutionary than what would appeal to even the mainstream collecting public, itself already a niche audience, let alone the mainstream public overall. PaceX is not going to hurt these other artists if it embraces ticket sales in hopes of attracting a mass audience. But it isn't necessarily going to help them, either. And while there's nothing wrong with that, it does set distinct limits on the model's impact. So until we know what other ideas PaceX may have in store, I think it's fair to conclude that the art market's future still looks a lot like its recent past." Again, that's from ArtNet. Here's some LA news. The Institute of Contemporary Art Los Angeles will soon be powered entirely by solar energy. This is also from ArtNet. The Institute of Contemporary Art Los Angeles is making history with its plan to switch entirely to solar power, which would make it one of the first nonprofits in the world to do so. The ICA has partnered with Kickstarter Arts to launch a crowdsourcing campaign that will cover the upfront capital costs. The initiative debuts as art institutions around the world are grappling with how to become more sustainable and fight climate change in an industry that requires constant travel, frequent shipping of heavy objects, and pricey climate control and HVAC systems. The museum, which recently appointed Hammer curator Ann Elgood as its new director, aims to raise $25,000 to install 206 solar panels and 6 inverters across the museum's 12,000 square feet of rooftop space. This will produce 100,000 kilowatt hours annually, allowing the museum to remove itself completely from the Los Angeles grid. The total estimated cost of the project is estimated $156,000, though much of this will be offset by the $30,000 per year the museum projects it will save in utility costs. It was also able to secure a significant rebate from the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, the museum's deputy director Samuel Vasquez told ArtNet News. Moving on, this arrow by mathematician and sculptor Kokichi Sugihara can't point left. Here's how it works. It's 3D printed with a bunch of curves our brains don't register. That's courtesy of Felix Salmon. And finally, this is from Old News on 8/19. World Museum in Liverpool defends use of facial recognition technology. The World Museum in Liverpool has said that it scanned visitors to its exhibition, China's First Emperor and the Terracotta Warriors, in 2018, with facial recognition technology. The acknowledgement from the museum came after it was criticized by the privacy campaign group Big Brother Watch. In its statement, the museum points out that it was following the advice of Merseyside police and local counterterrorism advisors in response to a heightened security risk, and that it was, quote, clearly communicated to visitors in signage around the venue, unquote. That is from Apollo Mag. That is all the clear communication to visitors that we have time for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Please support the show if you can. And I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Until then, ciao for now.